stress again to overcome problems that the human species has never faced in its roughly 200,000 years of existence. Problems of literally survival. We've already answered these questions for a huge number of species. We've killed them off.
Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author, institute professor emeritus at MIT. He taught there for over half a century. His latest book, Who Rules the World? If you want to watch part one of our conversation, it was all of Monday's show, go to democracynow.org. I'll be speaking today in Chicago at 6:30 with Jeremy Scahill at the Chicago Temple Building on West Washington Street. Then on Wednesday in Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater. To Toronto, Canada, Thursday and Friday. Then on to Saturday in Troy, New York at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. On Sunday in New York and on Monday at the Philadelphia Free Library. You can check our website at democracynow.org as we continue our 100-city tour. Oh, Democracy Now! Is hiring for our Video News Production Fellowship and our internship program. Get more information at our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival takes place this year from July 1st through 4th and includes performers like the Tedeschi Truck Band, Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Samantha Fish, and many, many more. Festival passes are on sale at early bird prices until May 31st. More information about the festival performers, the options for passes, and other information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
White Man Said Walk, the Teresa Rayford Disorderly Conduct Trial Show, airs Wednesday, May 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. Here's Prosecutor Lowe trying to question Ms. Rayford.
It's probably more than fair to say that you are very upset by the fact that you were arrested, is that correct?
I'm not upset by the fact that I'm arrested. I'm a protester, so a lot of the reason that we protest is to communicate the inequities about what's happening. And the fact that I was arrested gives us that opportunity. Thank you.
That's White Man Said Walk, this Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, it's the final day of elections here in Oregon's primary. Drop-off locations close at 8 p.m. We'll be covering the results live immediately following the newscast at 6 p.m.
KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama speaks with Harris Safar about Islamophobic messages in Hood River.
And for News in Depth, reporter Jamie Dodd speaks with Kristen Eberhard about fair alternative election systems. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 17th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. The final day of voting for the May Oregon primary has arrived. Voters can drop off ballots in person at any official drop site in Oregon until 8 p.m. tonight. Please note that postmarks do not count. Voters can find the nearest drop site anywhere in Oregon by visiting the Oregon Dropbox Locator by going to sos.oregon.gov and selecting the Dropbox Locator button on the left-hand side of the homepage. By this time, all registered voters should have received their ballots. Multnomah County voters who have not received ballots or need assistance should call Multnomah County Elections at 503-988-3720 or visit the elections office at 1040 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. Voters who have returned their ballots can check their ballot status at www.oregonvotes.gov or by signing up to track your ballot. Secure drop sites are located throughout Multnomah County, and voters can also drop off ballots in person at any county library. Boxes will be emptied regularly throughout the day and promptly at 8 p.m. tonight. A list of official ballot drop sites in Multnomah County is available online and below. The Multnomah County Elections Division will begin releasing unofficial results at 8 p.m. tonight at its office on its website at multco.us/elections/results and through its Twitter feed at Multco Elections. Unofficial elections results will be updated on the website throughout the election night as additional ballots are counted. If all of this is making your head spin, then you can just keep it tuned to KABU. We'll be covering the election live and speaking with various political parties, nominees, and winners around town, plus airing some interviews from the archives.
If you haven't voted and you're listening in Hood River or Philomath, you have until 8 p.m. to drop your ballot off. The following are other options for last-minute ballot drop-offs. In Hood River, at the county election office, there are boxes inside the third floor election headquarters and also in the ground floor lobby. That is at 601 State Street, Hood River, Oregon, and their doors are open tonight until 8 p.m. In Cascade Locks, drop off your ballot at City Hall. Their lobby is open until 8 p.m. tonight. In Benton County, you can go to the Benton County Courthouse at 120 Northwest 4th Street, Corvallis. The Wells Fargo and Timber Hill Shopping Center also has a drop-off, as does the Benton County Sunset Building at 4077 Southwest Research Way. You can also go to the Lincoln Health Center, the North Albany Shopping Center, and the Philomath Public Library. You can find indoor ballot drop boxes at the Corvallis Public Library, OSU Valley Library, the Senior Citizen Center of Corvallis, LBCC Benton Center, and the City Limits Market. Good luck and good voting.
Election officials are bracing for a record turnout in the Oregon primary, with 100,000 ballots coming in over the weekend. That brought the total number of ballots cast to a total of 673,000 as of yesterday. Not surprising in a state that is in the top 10 in the U.S. for voter participation. Oregon ranks number 6 with an approximate average of 60% of eligible voters casting their votes, 8.5 percentage points above the national average. Number 1 for voter participation is Minnesota, with 67.6% of eligible voters participating. Election officials are wondering whether they will see the volume of ballots they saw in the 2008 election year, where a record of 1 million ballots were cast in the primary. Despite potential for early voting that the state's vote-by-mail system allows, many voters still wait until Election Day to turn their ballots in. In the 2012 general election, this resulted in well over 400,000 ballots being cast on Election Day. Will the current contentious political climate inspire voters to once more turn in over a million ballots by the deadline of 8 o'clock tonight? Follow along with KABU as the results come in and the votes are counted.
Oregon isn't the only state with primaries today. Kentucky and Oregon share more than just a primary voting date. Here's a quick fact comparison of the two states. Both states have similar population sizes, upwards of 4 million citizens. Demographically, the two states have white populations at around 88%. Oregon's second largest demographic group is Hispanic and Latino. For Kentucky, it's African American. Both states are far from representative of the overall American landscape. 60.60% of Oregonians live in poverty. In Kentucky, it's 19.1%.
The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM's, proposed changes to forest protections in western Oregon could affect the 100-year Northwest Forest Plan, set up for the region more than two decades ago. Conservative groups are comparing the current proposal to a similar revision in 2008, which was ultimately struck down by a federal judge in 2012.
Conservation groups filed a protest yesterday against the Bureau of Land Management's latest proposal to change forest management in western Oregon. The BLM's revision eliminates some protections against logging near streams and could put the state out of step with the Northwest Forest Plan. That's the 100-year plan coordinated with Washington State and California. Susan Brown is an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center, which filed the protest on behalf of 22 conservation groups.
Our concern there is that by essentially pulling out of a range-wide regional plan, the BLM is leaving a huge hole in conservation and protection on those federal lands, and that may have all kinds of repercussions.
The Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994. If the BLM moves ahead with its revision, 2.6 million acres of land would be removed from the regional plan. Brown says the Northwest Forest Plan faced a similar challenge in 2008 when the BLM proposed the Western Oregon Plan revision, which would have increased logging on BLM-managed land. However, a federal judge declared that revised plan illegal in 2012. Brown says the newest proposal feels like a rehash of the last unsuccessful revision.
We seem to be having these conversations over and over again, and I wish that there was a more proactive attempt to really try to manage these lands in a way that would work for more of the public than what the BLM is attempting to do now.
The conservation group's protest says the BLM's newest plan reduces the buffer zones between logging activities and streams in certain areas, which could threaten water quality and wildlife. Reporting with the Oregon News Service, I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
A church in Hood River, Oregon has come under fire for its anti-Islamic messages. A Christian church in the small town in Eastern Oregon has posted anti-Islamic messages on its reader board in front of the church. Locals have complained and the town's mayor has condemned the church's actions. For further discussion, I spoke with Harris Safar from the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of Portland.
Well, it's certainly very disappointing that, of course, we accept the idea that there are differences of opinion between the faith traditions. We don't just ignore that and pretend like we're all the same. Certainly there are differences, but to see that instead of just expressing what a difference of a view is, that it would be going so far as to, you know, speak down about Islam as a way to promote one's own faith, that's certainly disappointing. And they're not trying to preach to the choir, right? Because it's saying, you know, hey, Christians, Allah is not, Muhammad is not greater than Jesus. Clearly, there are no Christians that believe that. There are no Christians that believe that the Quran is greater than the Bible. So they're not speaking to Christians right now. This is speaking more externally than their congregation or than the members of their own faith. This is a message to even Muslims that this is how they view our faith. So it certainly is disappointing. You know, I've been here now in Portland for 30 years, and I know that by far and large, people in this area are very open-minded and accepting. I saw that after 9/11, by the way, that the community refrained from judging Muslims by the actions of those lunatics. But here, you know, we have an example of, you know, some of the apples are kind of far away from the tree, in which people will judge Islam or try to talk down about Islam. And so I think we're really, what our reaction is going to be is trying to focus on finding ways to promote more dialogue. We love speaking with people. We love getting rid of these misconceptions and to demystify these mistruths. And we hope that people will take this as an opportunity to speak with us, because the things that are written on the sign are only seeking to divide and conquer. That's it.
How is the Muslim American community here in Portland reacting to candidates such as Donald Trump? And then you have actions like this. Does it feel attacking? And how are they responding?
Certainly we've seen the rhetoric of the likes of Donald Trump that would that feed on and prey on people's innate fears of something that they don't know. You know, the 2014 Pew Research poll said that 60% of Americans, don't know a Muslim. And when you have this large swath of Americans that don't know a Muslim, don't interact with a Muslim, don't have a Muslim friend or neighbor or colleague, then all they know about Islam is based on two sources. Number one, what they see in the news when lunatics like ISIS or Al-Qaeda and Taliban commit atrocious acts, and they see that being committed by people who call themselves Muslims. And then number two, when they have people that they trust, they look up to, like Donald Trump and like other political leaders or even religious leaders like Franklin Graham, et cetera, or Pat Robertson, who will fan the flames of mistrust of Muslims based off of something that's not even factual. So, yeah, it certainly feels like we've been now used as a political tool and also as the current manifestation of what we've seen historically in this country, unfortunately, that we've made this mistake of what we did to the Japanese in this country, what we did to Black Americans in this country, to a certain degree what we did to Catholics in this country and Jews in this country. And so it feels like now, instead of learning our lessons in which we have to apologize to these groups of people in the past, we have certain people that want us to repeat history, ignoring the voices within the Muslim world, even the Muslim communities here in the United States, that are calling for reconciliation, tolerance, interfaith, bridge building. Even the international leader of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community just this week was giving a talk in Denmark, and he said Islam counsels mankind to discard all forms of hatred. That's the Islam that we know, but that's not the Islam that people want to know. And so we really have to get past this deliberate ignorance. You know, if someone's ignorant because they don't have a chance to know about Islam, that's one thing. But this is deliberate ignorance, where you're intentionally fanning the flames of mistrust that shouldn't even be there because it's based off of falsehood.
How important is it then for local leaders to come out and speak out against actions like this, such as the mayor there in Hood River, as soon as people within that community started complaining, he immediately came out and said that he condemned the actions of this church? Is it important for people within the larger community, such as the mayor, to speak up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do commend the mayor for speaking out so quickly and so strongly. I think what's important, though, is to speak out in a way that invites people towards changing their view and towards dialogue. Because what we've seen, and it's the Donald Trump phenomena, is when people simply oppose and ridicule and mock, you know, those that are, you know, doing things like the sign, that are saying things that are intolerant, when the response is just to mock them and to ridicule them and to condemn them, then it puts those people into more of a cocoon where they now are going to defend themselves, and it creates a more of a divide. And I think that's why you see people who are so emotionally invested in Donald Trump, even though they don't even know what his policies are. And so I think for here and locally, I think we can apply that wisdom by not just, you know, ridiculing, calling them bigots or anything like that. I think it's important to counsel them. So I'd love to see the mayor find an opportunity to, even if it's private, if they don't want to do it in public, in the public square, find a way to have the leader of that church sit down with the mayor and hopefully even sit down with a Muslim leader or a Muslim person to have this conversation where we can agree that we have different philosophical and theological views, but that we don't have to see as the other person as a threat or something to preach against. In our faith, we are taught that we preach about something positive about ourselves as opposed to negative about someone else. And so I'd love to see that type of a dialogue take place, and maybe, you know, we'll all be richer as a result.
Lisa was saying that you work with the youth in your community. So I was wondering if you could possibly speak about what is important to them with what's happening today with the election.
There's a lot of talk amongst our youth around what this does in the dynamic, being raised in this environment that even I wasn't raised in, where it's so acceptable to say these things about not only Muslims, but say these things about Hispanics, that's come from the presidential campaign, about women, about African Americans, and so or immigrants in general. So there's this uneasiness about how well we are accepted or that we fit in. So that's why our work within the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and our youth association is to continue to inculcate this teaching that, yes, we're Muslims, here's what our faith teaches us, but yes, we're Americans, and there is no contradiction between the two. So feel like a loyal American, feel like a devout Muslim, and that your pledge of allegiance to one does not nullify the other. And so because that's being called into question, right? When you and your loyalty to the country are continually called into account, it has a psychological effect on those who are the target of that. So that's our focus, because we've seen that there is a dissent around why is it, why does this keep happening? And so we're trying to address that openly and honestly.
So you're saying that the youth that you work with, they're saying that they possibly, they're feeling more, like there's more targeted language than you felt growing up?
Yeah, I mean, so when I was 18, 19 years old, that was the late 90s. So it was all still pre-9/11. So there was just more unawareness. The ignorance about Islam was an unawareness. And so people didn't really, in the day-to-day discourse or on the news, there wasn't this overt prejudice against Islam or Muslims, or as much of an effort to deride Muslims or to create fear of them. That really started after 9/11, and I was 22 years old at, when 9/11 occurred. So the kids these days are living in this highly politicized, highly polarized political environment, which transcends religion. I mean, even the way that Republicans and Democrats disagree these days, it's not just a simple disagreement. It's to make the other side look like a complete buffoon who is anti-American and whose policies will ruin this country. So it's become so polarized that even is felt in the religious spectrum. So I think that the views against Muslims, the words against Muslims, and even the physical attacks against Muslims, mosques, you know, schools that have grossly risen in the past couple of years, the kids that are Muslim American kids who identify 100% as American, they know no other country, they're born and raised here, they're experiencing something that's very unique that not even I experienced growing up. And so it's very important for us to identify with them, to sympathize, and to find a way to ensure that they still feel like they're part and parcel of the American fabric of society. And so that's what our work has always been focused on, and we continue to focus on. And the fact that we're so socially connected these days, it amplifies it even more, where anyone can say anything, and that becomes news everywhere. And so we're trying to use those same channels, whether it's Telegram or Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat and Periscope, in order to connect with the youth and make and empower them that they are agents of change as loyal Americans, that they can help fix these issues and address the concerns of their fellow Americans.
Well, speaking about them feeling empowered, how is the eagerness to vote for the Ahmadiyya Muslim community right now? Does it seem like there's going to be a large voter turnout?
It does, yes, it does appear, because we have been speaking about that part of our, when we say we're loyal to this country, part of that is to live out our civic duty, and voting is certainly part of that. We do not take, as a community, an official political stand. So I do know members of my own community, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, who are raging liberals, and I know those that are radical conservatives and everything in between. And so there may be different political viewpoints on things. So our focus, though, is on making sure everyone feels that they're part of this country, and so as part of that, to make sure that you have a voice in the direction the country is going. So yes, we have been trying to encourage. We're not keeping a tally or a track. We're not doing something so sophisticated or formalized. It's a more of, you know, everyone should vote. This is our responsibility and a privilege that we're not given in every country that we live in. So let's make sure we take full benefit from that.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Harris.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Harris Zafar of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of Portland.
Nevada became the setting of political spectacle on Saturday at the state's Democratic Convention. On Saturday, Clinton and Sanders supporters butted heads repeatedly over delegate allocation procedures, contested delegate counts, and delegate ineligibility. Sanders was left with fewer delegates being sent to the convention than originally anticipated. Cell phone videos of shouting matches and skirmishes between party members flooded social media. 2 days after the heat, the Nevada Democratic Party sent out a formal complaint to Sanders' campaign, accusing members of violence and creating a, quote, very dangerous atmosphere that ended in chaos and physical threats to fellow Democrats, end quote. The Sanders campaign condemned the threatening remarks made by his supporters, but recognize their frustrations at the event. The spectacle may just be a taste of what's to come in the case of a contested national convention later this July in Philadelphia, as Sanders and his supporters are promising.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Pouty, whiny, spoiled bratism is not nice coming from a four-year-old, but it's grotesque when it comes from billion-dollar corporate elites like Uber and Lyft. The two far-hire car companies call their service ride-sharing, but these internet-based brats are takers, not sharers, and the bulk of the fares they charge end up in the pockets of their faraway hedge fund owners. Still, they insist that they are new economy tech-driven geniuses that are above the fusty old local laws that other transportation companies follow. So Uber and Lyft have made it a corporate policy to throw hissy fits when cities from Los Angeles to Atlanta, Houston to Portland, have dared even to propose that they obey rules to protect customers and drivers. The latest tantrum from the California giants came in Austin when the city council adopted a few modest, perfectly reasonable rules. The petulant duo then used high-pressure tactics to force a special election to overturn the council's action. Being brats, they assumed that locals would flock to do whatever the popular service wanted. But they picked the wrong city. First, they ran a campaign of blatant lies, as though Austinites wouldn't question them. Then, they shoved a sickening level of corporate cash into their campaign, apparently thinking that the sheer tonnage of mendacious ads would win the day for them. However, the slicks from California turned out to be Uber goobers. Despite spending $9 million, more than the combined spending of all city council candidates in the past decade, they went down 56% to 44%. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Uber and Lyft have now left town in a huff. But who needs them? A new Texas-based upstart called GetMe has already moved in to fill the void with community spirit rather than pouty corporate arrogance, saying it's happy to comply with sensible rules that the people want.
This primary season, don't give in to panic. Here's the latest from Laura Flanders in the F Word.
Well, here we are in my least favorite phase of the election season, the part where pundits and politicians pile on masse to pull public aspirations back. Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, calls it the "we shouldn't even try" attitude common among establishment Democrats. Ralph Nader calls them the hereditary Democratic opinion shapers, who tell their audiences to line up behind experience and electability as if it's that or certain death. This is designed to panic and mute their followers, says Nader, and all too often it does just that. Think about it. What brings people into the political process? I think of what Progressive Caucus co-chair Keith Ellison said when I asked him if he liked campaigning. "I love it," he responded. "It's the time in the year when we talk to our neighbors about their lives and why we care." His eyes lit up. Sure enough, a successful candidate is one like Ellison, the guy who rallies people to believe that the future is about more than fear and that change is possible in their lives, in their families, in their country, and they can be part of it. Bernie Sanders has rallied a lot of people just that way, most especially young voters. He's received 80%+ of the youth vote in several states. What happens in elections is candidates talk to people, eyes bright, promises on their lips. They persuade people they can be powerful, they matter, they're needed. But what we tend to mean is vote. And after voting, people are expected to cede all their political power back to their political representatives. The panic and mute sets in early in the U.S. system, right after the primaries. No wonder the electorate shrinks smaller and smaller. Will Sanders supporters shrink back? What if they don't? What if they channeled their energy into building progressive power at the local level? What if they refused to give in to panic and mute? Tell me what you think. Write to me, laura@lauraflanders.com.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Verizon workers on strike since April 13th will bargain again with the company Tuesday as the Obama administration gets involved in efforts to settle the strike. U.S. Labor Secretary Tom Perez met with Verizon, CWA President Chris Shelton, and IBEW President Lonnie Stephenson over the weekend. CWA members trying to visit a Verizon call center in the Philippines were chased off the property
by armed security, and then followed by armed and masked Philippines SWAT police a couple of days ago, but eventually the union members were allowed to go on their way with no injuries. Outsourcing U.S. jobs to call centers like that one in the Philippines is one of the strike issues. Roughly 39,000 Verizon workers are on strike. The American Federation of Government Employees is calling for 6,000 more full-time security screeners at U.S. airports. The union says Congress must pass emergency funding to address years of budget cuts. The flying public is experiencing long lines at airport security checkpoints, and AFGE says the additional personnel would help shorten the lines and delays that passengers are experiencing. There are about 42,000 TSA security officers working airports now, compared to 47,000 in 2013. An investigation by the U.S. Labor Department found that 24 businesses in Madison, Wisconsin allegedly owe 275 workers $724,000 in back pay. The targeted investigations looked at randomly selected restaurants and hotels in the Madison area. David King is district director for the Wage and Hour Division of the U.S. Department of Labor for Wisconsin and Minnesota.
We're concerned with making sure employees are paid in accordance with federal law.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa rallied Monday with First Student bus drivers and monitors who transport students for Baltimore Public Schools. They were celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Teamsters Drive Up Standards campaign to organize school bus drivers and improve their working conditions. Since launching the campaign in 2006, 45,000 bus workers at more than 400 bus yards in the U.S. and Canada have joined the Teamsters. AFL-CIO Vice President Tafari Gebre will be in Flint, Michigan Tuesday, meeting with union plumbers who are working to replace water lines to help deal with the city's water crisis. Emergency financial managers answering to Michigan Governor Rick Snyder poisoned Flint's water supply with lead by switching water sources from Lake Huron to the Flint River and then failing to properly treat the water. The corrosive, polluted water released lead from plumbing pipes into the water supply. Gebre is meeting with other groups providing relief services to Flint residents during his Tuesday visit to the city.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the Office and Professional Employees International Union, online at opeiu.org, and by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, online at goiam.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. It is the final evening of the Oregon primary election, and the PM News team will be hosting a special report covering the results as they are released. In between announcing election results as they filter in, we'll be airing live and also archived election-related interviews the news team has conducted over the past few months, so stay tuned. Tonight's weather will be slightly cloudy, clearing up later into the evening. Tomorrow morning will be sunny, with a possibility of showers into the afternoon. High of 73 during the day, an increased chance of rain into the evening. Today in history, in 2004, Massachusetts became the first U.S. state to legalize gay marriage. It came on the heels of appellate court case Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health, in which it was ruled that same-sex couples could legally be married in the state. The plaintiffs, who won the case, were the first same-sex couple to be legally wedded in the United States.
Tens of thousands of people demonstrated today in France after the government used a rarely invoked article in the French Constitution to push a controversial labor law through the parliament last week, bypassing lawmakers who were widely expected to reject the measure. Opponents of the bill say it weakens worker protections. After several weeks of widespread protests, demonstrators now hope a massive mobilization against the proposed law will make the government reverse course. From Paris, Raphael Croft reports.
Cette loi, elle va passer.
This law will be adopted, and I will not give up like so many did before me, French President François Hollande said this morning on French private radio Europe 1, referring to the labor law his government pushed through last week. using an obscure provision of the French Constitution known as Article 49.3. Just a few hours later, tens of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets, marching in many of France's main cities. According to opponents, the law will weaken labor protections, making it easier for employers to fire workers. Sébastien, a 30-year-old private telephone company employee, chose not to give his last name.
I am here to express my anger against this law, against all they do, especially against 49.3. I didn't think France could be a dictatorship. That's why I'm here.
Although polls say a majority of French people are against this proposed reform, observers believe the government is expecting the movement to run out of steam. At the end of March, nearly 400,000 people marched in protest. Today, just a small fraction of that number demonstrated. Trade unions are divided on the best strategy to adopt. And the strikes they called in public transport, including France's ports, trains and airports, have not been broad enough to make any real impact nationwide. But another rally is set for next Thursday. Police response to protests is often harsh. Tomorrow, French police will gather on Place de la République for their own demonstration against police hatred in a move many here see as provocation ahead of further anti-government actions. Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Since the closure of the Balkan borders, there has been a notable decline in the amount of refugees arriving in Greece from Turkey. But what about the 54,000 that are left stranded all across the country? Most of them are homeless or living in poor conditions, but some Greek activists have begun to use civil disobedience to address a humanitarian crisis that the state is unable to handle. Andrew Connolly reports from Athens.
The spirit of political resistance, so pervasive in the streets of Greece, has spread into the reception of a long-abandoned hotel in downtown Athens. Radical Greek activists have occupied the seven-story building and transformed it into a cooperative sanctuary for hundreds of refugee families. The border closures of Greece's northern neighbors, from Macedonia to Austria, have trapped over 54,000 refugees in Greece, many of them homeless or living in squalid camps scattered the length and breadth of the country. On an afternoon in May, the dining room of what was once a privately operated three-star hotel, known as the City Plaza, is a cacophony of Greek, English, Arabic and Farsi as the daily assembly is held. Lukia, one of the Greek activists behind the occupation, explains their motivation.
So the concept is to build new communities, to build new communities of coexistence between refugees and the local population. What is at the same time very urgent is to start to work with the idea and the reality that we are going to live together. Because thousands of people were captured in Greece. They didn't want to stay in Greece. They wanted to, you know, a lot of women here are waiting to go to Germany or to other countries where their husbands are already there.
The UNHCR estimates that over 60% of Greece's trapped refugees are women and children. The occupied City Plaza Hotel offers them a respite, including for those that have decided to leave the makeshift camps near the sealed borders. In April, in the border town of Idomeni, FSRN met Nezrin, an English teacher from Aleppo. She's now in the Athens hotel, making a coffee with one hand, while balancing her two-year-old son, Basel, with the other. In recent weeks, Syria's largest city has seen a relentless and deadly bombardment by the air force of President Assad.
Or the women think that if my husband will be in Germany, so about 1 month, 2 months, 5 months maximum, I will be with him. But now it's about 1 year without anything. So I decided to go to this place by boat alone with my son, just to reach that. My husband, I want to be with my family. Yeah, well, it's, I don't know, I cannot hold alone all this trouble things.
Nesrin's husband, Zaher, fled Syria to Dortmund last year to find work with the hope that family reunification laws would be able to swiftly and safely bring his wife and son across. Nesrin waited a year in Turkey. But as Germany struggled under the sheer weight of asylum claims, she decided to make the journey with her son. The limbo is hard, but Nesrin appreciates the effort of the City Plaza activists.
They are good people. Yeah, they are nice people. Maybe because they are poor like us. They don't have that ideology thinking about material and money. And they know about war because they lived a long time like the days that we live.
One of the hotel activists, journalist Yanis Androulidakis, has a deeper connection to his guests than most. His father was a Greek refugee from Turkey who subsequently fled to France to escape oppression under the military dictatorship of the 60s. Androulidakis emphasizes the importance of sharing the duties of the hotel with the refugees and helping them integrate into Greece, their unexpected new home.
Our plan is to make places, to create places in the middle of the cities where the refugees can live, so in order to be part of our society. Maybe not today, but live in dignity, have food and somewhere to sleep, and then begin to fight for the rights and be part of our society just like us.
The City Plaza is also a metaphor for Greece's ailing fortunes. Built before the 2004 Olympics, with loans freely given out in the boom years, the business folded shortly after as the country began its descent into chronic economic depression. The activists claimed the boss withheld the employee's salary, but Androulidakis says the former workers are on their side and support the hotel's new role in alleviating the humanitarian crisis.
Maybe 100 hotels opened before the Olympic Games, take the money and run. So now we have 100 empty hotels in the center of Athens, and in the same time, 50,000 people who live in the streets. I think the symbolism is that it was so to everyone that it's very easy that people go to empty buildings and they leave. You know, it's about 300 people here. That means it's not the 1%, but 0.5% of all the refugees in Greece. And this is not the big thing. Some people thought about it, we did it.
Although an illegal occupation, for now the authorities have left City Plaza alone, no doubt grateful that it's a few hundred less refugees for them to worry about. As the evening draws in, an American blues musician plays for children from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and beyond. Thousands of refugees remain homeless in Greece, many of them locked up in detention centers on the Greek islands. But tonight, the City Plaza will shelter 400 guests, and in doing so, providing a glimpse of an alternative approach to housing asylum seekers, far removed from segregation and incarceration. Andrew Connolly, FSRN, Athens.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad, Jenny Yokoyama, Dominic Anaya, and Theo Burke. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday, talk radio Ralph Nader joins host Paul Rowland for the first half of the show. They'll discuss various issues related to the Oregon primary and the national political scene. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Joanne Hardesty looks at the Oregon primary with a focus on the local races. She'll invite your calls. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Food Show, host Chris Siegel speaks with Anna Thomas, author of The Vegetarian Epicure, cookbooks about her new book, Vegan Vegetarian Omnivore. He also interviews Lynn Curry, Eastern Oregon resident and author of the book, Pure Beef. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. You are key to keeping KBOO strong. That's it for the first segment of tonight's newscast. Stay tuned for news in depth, followed by Oregon primary election coverage.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
If you're following the election system closely, you may be asking yourself, is there a better way to do this? KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad spoke with Kristen Eberhard of the Sightline Institute about her ongoing series looking into alternative forms of election systems and how we can make our democracy a bit more democratic.
I'm speaking today with Kristen Eberhard of the Sightline Institute. She has published an ongoing series on how archaic voting systems cripple democracy. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How would you define the term archaic voting system?
Voting systems that came about in the 18th century and don't actually work that well and haven't been updated since.
Why do you think it's so important to have a conversation about alternative forms of democracy?
I think everybody could probably agree that our democracy is not at its most shining moment right now. And that's